I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to Radio Times. Philadelphia did what New York City was not able to do, pass a beverage tax. Mayor Jim Kenney just signed legislation that puts a 1.5 cents per ounce levy on both sugar-sweetened and diet drinks, and that includes sodas, sports drinks, flavored water, energy drinks, bottled coffee, and more. It will be paid by the distributor, who will no doubt pass it along to the customer. Now, the mayor originally wanted the revenue from taxing sugary drinks to mostly pay for pre-K for thousands more of the city's youngsters. But after negotiations with city council, the money will be shared between pre-K and other city programs and services, including the general fund. The city will be on national display at the end of July when it hosts the Democratic National Convention. Mayor Jim Kenney is finishing up his first 6 months in office, a good time to check in with him. He was last on the show when he was running for this job. And Mayor Kenney, nice to have you with us
on
Radio Times.
Nice to be back.
Are you used to people calling you Mr. Mayor?
I like Jim.
You like Jim better than Mr. Mayor?
Or Your Honor's even worse. I'm
just like, do people do that?
Yeah. I mean, it's nice and people are respectful and I appreciate that. But Jim's my name and that's what my mother calls me. So I prefer
Jim. You're going to stick with Jim. Yeah. So how was Philadelphia able to pass a sugary drinks or and also a diet drink tax? Mayor Nutter tried this. Mayor Bloomberg in New York tried this. How was Philadelphia able to do this?
Well, we tied it directly to specific programs and initiatives that people wanted to see. I mean, pre-K was clearly something that was popular within the electorate, within the citizens in Philadelphia. Community schools were also very popular. And everyone wants their library, rec center, and park to be pristine, to be quality structures and quality places to be. So when we tied those issues to the revenue generation, people understood it. There are, of course, ancillary health benefits to not drinking sugar-sweetened beverages, but that's not what we based it on. And let me just make one comment on your earlier intro.
Sure.
There's about $400 million going to be raised over the course of the five-year plan with this proposal. Only $41 million will be sitting in the general fund for 1 year. What happens is we start to collect the tax and you start ramping up the programs. So there's not as much needed in the beginning years for pre-K and for community schools. But in the out years, that 41 is going to all be going to pre-K community schools and parks, recs, and libraries. So that was kind of the last-ditched effort of the soda industry to derail this proposal. And again, it's for 1 year, it's $41 million, and that $41 million will ultimately be spent on all the programs we promised to do.
Now, the soda industry, as it is called, there is a court challenge. They're saying I ran across a quote saying we're ready.
Well, they haven't filed yet.
They haven't filed yet.
And as soon as they file, we will read it and be prepared to defend it.
And defend it how?
Because we believe it's constitutional. We believe that we have a right to do so. And our law department and outside counsel have both opined that we could do this. If we were told earlier that we couldn't do it or it was illegal, we wouldn't have proceeded with it. But we'll see what their complaint says. They have a lot of money. They spent a lot of money on misinformation when it came to the campaign. They called it a grocery tax, and it never was a grocery tax. And then they tried to derail it with a couple other things. So, I mean, they'll have high-paid lawyers and lobbyists continuing their fight to save their billions of dollars in profits. But we'll fight them, and we were successful in the first round. I know we'll be successful in the second.
Your side also had Philadelphians for a Fair Future. My understanding is that a lot of that money came from Michael Bloomberg.
Well, most of it came from him and the Arnold Foundation, and they disclosed those contributions right up front, so there was no dark money, quote unquote.
There were some questions about whether this was dark money.
When they gave us the money, they told we announced who was giving it to us. I mean, you know, it's kind of comical when you talk about dark money with Philadelphians for a Fair Future when the soda industry is spending tens of millions of dollars of their profits off of soda to fight something that both would help our community and our kids and make people healthier.
One of the arguments is that if you tax this stuff, there could be job loss associated with that because people are not going to be buying now both sugary drinks and also sugar-free drinks.
Right. Well, diet was not our preference. We wanted 2 cents, originally 3 cents on sugar. Kind of realized that was a little too high, so we thought two.
We'd fall back to two.
We wanted two on sugar, and council insisted on putting in. Members of council insisted on putting in diet, and then we did to get it passed. 1.5 on sugar is good, we'll see how they. And there's no guarantee they're going to pass it on. They say they will, and I'm sure they'll pass on some of it.
Right.
But I don't know if they pass on all of it. They can afford to eat some of it. They've been marketing and selling this product to poor communities for generations, and creating situations where the highest amount of acquired diabetes is in the African American and Latino community because they market as much as they do in those communities as opposed to others. So, I mean, they have a responsibility to leave some of that money in that neighborhood.
Interestingly, though, you and your administration didn't make the health argument. No. You felt like that was just a non-starter?
Well, the Nutter administration tried that twice, and it failed. I think there is an inherent in Americans, and especially in Philadelphians, because of our attitudes about things, that this nanny state push, smoking, sugar, you know, that is something people reject instinctively. And we decided that if we tied it to areas which are health related, mm-hmm. I mean, if you have kids who are prepared for kindergarten, first grade, that's healthy. If you have kids in school that are getting medical, dental, and other services, social services, psychological services in the school base, that's health. If you have a great rec center and park, that's healthy because people have places to go and recreate. And if you have a great library, people can come in and learn about health and find jobs and do things to make them healthy.
I do want to talk about the pre-K part of this, but it is interesting, and perhaps more cities and even states have to raise money on sugary drinks or even non-sugary drinks, right. On liquor, on smoking, and all these quote-unquote syntax, on lotteries, things like that. Is that what we're going to have to get used to?
Well, because the legislature won't raise the personal income tax. I mean, if you want a broad-based tax that people pay as they can afford, that will generate enough money for schools and infrastructure, and the legislature refuses to do it, you wind up with gaming. You wind up with sin taxes, you wind up with lotteries, you wind up with kind of gimmicks as opposed to facing what their responsibility is, and that's to provide revenue, to provide services, to keep the public healthy, safe, and to keep the Commonwealth moving forward. And since they've all signed, well, not all, but many of them signed these Grover Norquist – I don't understand the Grover Norquist phenomenon. I mean, it's like
years.
Who is Grover Norquist and why did you sign this pledge? Never to raise taxes under any circumstances ever, even if there's a famine or – earthquake or it just don't make any sense. And it's the way it is right now. So we are stuck with having to find other ways of raising. Now, people say, well, why don't you just raise real estate taxes?
Right.
Well, we've done that because the legislature has not provided the funds to fully fund education. We've raised real estate taxes four out of five years, to provide $400 million in new money for the schools. We may have to go back there in another year or two if the legislature continues to refuse to fully fund education. And I wanted to have that in abeyance in case we can't open our schools and we need to do that. I mean, the problem in the nation and the problem in the state is that there's a belief amongst legislative leaders that somehow education is a luxury and not a requirement. I mean, that's crazy. I mean, how can you not educate your folks and expect to create well-paying jobs and good taxpayers and a strong economy if people are uneducated? It makes no sense at all.
Well, let's talk about pre-K, and this was really the centerpiece of why you wanted this increased tax. The question is, can you get the kind of good pre-K with well-paid teachers who give youngsters, especially youngsters at risk, a head start on their education?
Well, people are doing it now. I mean, there are a myriad of pre-Ks, quality pre-Ks throughout our city, in neighborhoods, generally run by African American women. It's a great base of business opportunities for people to get into that. There are other folks who run it, but most of the ones I've been into are women of color who are working in neighborhoods, educating kids in a quality way. I agree that the pay of the teachers need to be addressed, and we're going to address that in this program. And they need the assistance to expand their seats. We go to a quality pre-K and the operation is taking care of 30 kids and there's 60 kids on a waiting list,
right.
And space inside the facility to expand it. So we're not looking to recreate the wheel. We're looking to support existing pre-Ks that are out there doing great work and expanding their seats and expanding reach into the neighborhoods.
Is there a role for the school district?
Yeah, I mean, the school district has space. I mean, there are space in schools. The PFT has been very, very cooperative with considering, you know, allowing us to bring in operators to run pre-K in the existing school base that have space and seats and classrooms. But there are folks out there doing this quality pre-K now who know what they're doing, and they're in neighborhoods that are accessible so people can drop off their kids before they go to work and get that quality pre-K experience. I have been in these facilities. I've seen these kids in every neighborhood in the city, regardless of how difficult the neighborhood is. These young kids are pristine sponges of knowledge. They want to learn, and they want to know about everything and touch everything and hug you, and they don't see race. And it's just a wonderful experience to see these little children. But by the time they get to third grade, if they're not reading at grade level, and seventh and eighth grade are so embarrassed about their lack of education that they start acting up and acting out, and in ninth and tenth grade, we lose them and they go to the streets.
In fact, you think of pre-K as changing, and I'm quoting here, changing the narrative of poverty in our city.
I mean, the only thing that's changed poverty and equality and civil rights in this country is access to education. I mean, there was a reason why slave owners wouldn't let slaves learn how to read. I mean, because they knew that an educated person was an independent person that would think for themselves. And we need to make sure that our kids have that base. And I would like to do it earlier than 3 years old. I mean, obviously, learning starts as soon as you're born.
Absolutely.
Three and four is what we can really handle.
Well, and the goal looks like it's 10,000 seats. That's the way we talk about
4 years, yeah.
Young people or students by the year 2020.
That's our goal.
And how, when you look across the city, how many children do you think could benefit from
probably PK? There's probably another 10,000 that you know we need to get to, and in the out years after the fourth or fifth year, we can start expanding it into making it universal. Right now,
is that the goal? Universal?
Well, yeah, I mean, I would like every 3 and 4 year old in our city to have a quality pre-K experience. But right now, we're talking about quality pre-K, and that's the 3 and 4 star pre-Ks that are judged by the state to be quality.
So they have to be essentially licensed or evaluated.
There's a bunch of standards that they need to meet. We're going to help part of our programs to help these 2 and 1 and 2 star pre-Ks get to the 3 and 4s. A lot of it has to do with bureaucracy and paperwork. Mm-hmm. And they don't have the time or the energy to do it. So we will create an environment or a back of the house operation to help them with that paperwork. To help them, we have a wonderful grant of $15 million from the William Penn Foundation to do capital improvements and facilities. And William Penn Foundation has been just awesome in this effort, and we can't thank them enough because they gave us an initial credibility in the effort.
A larger question is that once these youngsters get into public schools or even charter schools, do they retain that early intervention, the kind of preparation that they have, so that when they get to third grade or seventh grade, they're performing?
Yeah, I mean, studies have shown that if you have that pre-K experience, you're going to be a much more productive kindergartner or first grader, and then that goes on. And then the teachers have a chance to get the kids to the next step as opposed to bringing them back from falling behind. So if you get a kid who's never had a pre-K experience, hasn't been socialized, doesn't know their colors, their numbers, their letters, haven't been in a classroom setting, it's a whole new experience, and that teacher now needs to pay more attention and put more effort into that child to get them up to speed. If they start out that way, they can then progress.
And how soon do you think you can begin to expand on pre-K in Philly?
Well, we'll start collecting the tax in January, and in September we'll start rolling them out.
So in about a year's time?
About a year's time.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kenney, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. We're talking about the beverage tax that was passed. He just signed it. Its impact on the city. We'll be talking about some other issues as well, including plans for the Democratic National Convention coming to town in about a month's time. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. Stay with us. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, again talking with Philadelphia's new mayor, signed the oath of office in January, about 6 months on the job. And again, you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. Just a quick tweet here from John. With the inclusion of a diet, any health benefit from a sugar diversion has been eliminated. Do you agree with that?
No. I mean, I think that less sugar will be less liquid sugar will be consumed. I mean, I wanted it at 2 cents,
right.
And not having it on diet, but it is what it is. No piece of legislation is perfect, and you need 9 votes. We got 13, which was really stunning as far as I was concerned. And we'll work with it and move forward.
One little follow-up there. One of the arguments against it is that, people are going to go across lines. So the way people go to Delaware, New Jersey to get their alcohol, they'll cross lines and go to the suburbs to get their sodas?
I think initially that may be the case. I think the convenience factor. If you're going to go to Jersey, you got to pay $5 to use the bridge. So, I mean, I don't know how much, you know, and your gas, even though it's cheaper now. But I think people do it angrily in the beginning. We had the same arguments being made about cigarettes and about alcohol. You know, when we did the drink tax, which I did not support at the time, but the liquor by the drink tax, there was never going to be a bar or restaurant open in the city forever. And we've had 5 or 6 times as many bars and restaurants open. People are still sadly smoking, even with, you know, when a carton of cigarettes was $5 back in the 60s, it's now $100. People are still consuming them. Yeah. So I think people will initially, you know, will protest a little bit and do that, but I think they'll be back because it's convenient.
You had a piece in the Philadelphia Inquirer, I guess it was. Yo, Philly, you don't want to miss this convention. This is about the Democrats coming to town, about 50,000 of them.
There were some misplaced situations relative to the Pope and kind of the doomsday scenario when people ran out of town, ran to the shore, ran to the mountains.
The sense that the city was going to get shut down.
Right. But this is a 50,000-person event for you know, a number of days. It's smaller than an Eagles game at the same location. And remember that during the course of the event, the delegates will be at the Wells Fargo Center from like 5 to 10, 11 o'clock at night. So all those restaurant seats are available. You know, make sure you take advantage of Political Fest at the convention center, the food truck, the block party in Old City. I mean, there's a whole bunch of things that are going – oh, no, I'm sorry. Block party in Old City is for the convention. I'm mixing up my 4th of July and my DNC. But there will be a number of events that are free for people to enjoy. And the important part about the DNC, in addition to nominating the first woman president of the United States, which is what we're going to do, it's important for people, for Philadelphians, to mix with the rest of the country because people will make vacation decisions, will make convention decisions based on their experience here. And to interact with real Philadelphians is wonderful because we are wonderful people. We are friendly. We are helpful. We're opinionated, outspoken. And you can get a good interaction with people from Nevada and from Utah and from Florida and from Virginia. And I think that's a great experience for both the delegates and for the citizens of the city, is to have that interaction with the rest of the country.
Are there lessons from the 2000 Republican convention? More than 400 people, for instance, were arrested as they were protesting the convention. What is the city going to do differently?
Our goal is to arrest no one. We recognize the First Amendment is sacrosanct in this country, and you have a right to express your opinion as loud and as long as you like. We would like you to get a permit so we know where you're going to be, and we can provide for porta-potties and misting tents and things because it may be hot. And to make sure that everybody's safe and we can secure the area well. You know, people have threatened that they're going to protest without a permit. That's fine. I mean, we're not going to arrest
them. Not a big deal?
No. I mean, our preference is that you would tell us where you want to go, how big it's going to be potentially, and what are your needs, and we'll be happy to help you with those. And if you protest without a permit, we're not going to arrest you either. I mean,
you're going to fine them?
Well, we decriminalized a lot of the former criminal penalties that were for failure to disperse and public drunkenness and public urination and you know, those kinds of things are all now civil fines and they're not criminal. We're not going to arrest you for that. Look, we just want everybody to express themselves, enjoy themselves, feel part of something, whether you're protesting something or you're supporting something. Do it here. Do it safely. Our only rules are you can't destroy property and you can't hurt anybody.
The ACLU has filed suits basically saying that the protest restrictions, and I think there's some along Broad Street, violate a First Amendment right of some of these protesters.
We're not limiting protests on Broad Street. We're just trying to keep it from happening during rush hour. And that's a safety issue.
Is that 3 to 6? Is that rush hour?
No, rush hour is usually, I think, 4 to 6.
4 to 6, okay.
But it's an issue of public safety. I mean, because if you have to get an ambulance or a fire truck or a police car through traffic, I mean, when it's being – it just makes more sense. And we're trying to be sensible and rational about all of this. We recognize that there's going to be protests. This is an opportunity for people to express to their future leaders what it is they're concerned or unhappy about. And we think that's what Philadelphia was created for, came out of Philadelphia in the first place. The major protest of America was the revolution. So, we understand that. It's part of our culture. But we just want people to be safe.
So if people want to demonstrate on Broad Street, just do it between –
Well, tell us where you want to be.
Okay.
And we'll get the permit processed, and then we'll be prepared. And sometimes people want the same spots at the same time, which is, you know, you have to sort that stuff out. And the process of processing the paperwork just takes a little bit of time. We're not delaying it on purpose. It's just a matter of there's a queue of requests, and we're trying to get through them and make it work.
Would there be certain kinds of protesters who would be denied a permit?
No. I mean, if you ask for a permit, unless the space is already taken by another group, I don't see why you would be denied.
And how close can protesters get to the convention itself or wherever the delegates are?
Well, that's up to the Secret Service. I mean, mm-hmm. there are certain levels of involvement we have where when it comes to the Wells Fargo Center, Secret Service is in charge because there's dignitaries there. The president will be there at some point. The nominees will be there. I mean, we have to abide by their rules. We are setting up a situation over at Franklin Roosevelt Park, which is south. If you're from South Philly, it's the lakes,
right.
Where we have porta potties, where we'll have misting tents, where we'll have water, where we'll have things for people, and those folks will be visible to the delegates from the Wells Fargo Center to FDR. And we'll roll with it and we did it I don't expect to have the same situation that we had at the RNC. I really don't.
Have you been talking with the police department just to make sure that all these things
on a regular basis? You have to remember. I mean, Commissioner Ramsey, to his credit, when we had Occupy, and that was a long period of time
around City Hall,
at every police roll call, which took place at Occupy, the First Amendment was read to the officers. Their responsibility is to protect that right, to protect people from hurting each other or people from destroying property, but it is their responsibility to protect the right of expression, which is what we're about.
And what will you be doing, Mayor Kenney, while the DNC is going on?
Making sure the trains run on time.
Is that right?
I have a responsibility, apparently, to open up with a welcoming address the first day. I have no predisposition as to what other role I have. If the Clinton folks want me to do something, I'll be happy to do it. If the DNC wants me to do something, I'll be happy to do it. But I have no predisposition as to what other role I have other than being mayor and being a good host.
You are a Hillary Clinton supporter. Yes. Have you thought about a vice president for her?
Elizabeth Warren looked pretty good the other day, taking Trump on. I think that might be an interesting and fun campaign. I don't know whether or not she wants to be whether Senator Warren wants to be a number two or not. But she was dynamic. It was fabulous. And despite what Ed Rendell says, I don't think two women on a ticket are a drawback because two women on a ticket are a drawback, then two men on a ticket are a drawback. So, and we've had that for a long, long time. So
it is 2016.
Right? I think two women would be intriguing and fun. And I think that. That Senator Warren would get under his crazy hair pretty good.
And what do you think about Donald Trump?
I think he's dangerous. I think he's dangerous. I think he's rude. He's loud. He's misogynist. He's xenophobic. He's borderline racist. I don't know why anyone would be attracted to that type of speech. And it seems to me that he should have been vetted earlier by the press on a lot of things. And now the Republicans have him, and I don't know if the mainstream Republicans want him. They're kind of stuck with what they have now.
And Pennsylvania is being more and more described as a battleground state.
It is.
Which is where this will be fought.
Yeah, here, Ohio, Virginia, places like that. And look, and it's nice to be in play. And I think that the citizens of Philadelphia in this region who are moderate, decent people, whether they're Democrats or Republicans, have to come out and vote. And they have to determine whether or not they really want to put the future of this country in Donald Trump's hands.
And that's Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kenney. And we are talking about preparing for the DNC in a month's time. Also, the beverage tax that was just passed. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Larry from Newtown to join us. Larry, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
Good morning.
Mr. Mayor, I seem to have read in the media about the unions here in Philadelphia have been agreed to relaxing rules and regulations with the convention coming up. How does that square with the principles of the Democratic Party?
What are you talking about, Larry?
Well, in terms of work relations, something like the Pennsylvania Convention Center, there were certain regulations, let's say, for the different unions. And now with the Democratic convention coming, it's not the same thing, that they're making special concessions because they don't want to make labor issues to be on the national spotlight.
Well, Larry, let's see what the mayor says.
I'm not aware of any special concessions. I do know that the unions, since the changes at the convention center that the unions helped create, have created a situation where we're booking many more conventions. People who said they would never come back to Philadelphia are rebooking their conventions. I think that the unions understand that this is a hospitality industry. It's not necessarily a construction site, and that you need to be hospitable, and they understand that, and they're working through it, and it's become successful. And there were negotiations and discussions down at the Wells Fargo Center about the construction or reconstruction of Wells Fargo to accommodate the event, and everything went smoothly, and people like John Dougherty and Ryan Boyer and other folks have done a really good job in putting the labor force out there and helping and being cooperative, both at the convention center and at the Wells Fargo Center. So everybody's happy as far as I know.
Larry, thanks for the call. Let's see what David from Northern Liberties has to say. David, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Sure, go ahead.
I am a supporter of the 2 or 3 cent sugar tax on drinks, but I was wondering if the mayor considered any other ways of raising revenue, like phasing out the 10-year tax abatement. Being in Northern Liberties, the 10-year tax abatement just seems like it's past its prime. It doesn't have a rationale anymore. And there's plenty of reasons for people to build in the city and move to the city.
Sure. David, thanks.
And I do understand the dilemma relative to the varying versions of people's attitude about the tax abatement. But let me tell you, Carl Dranoff is building a large condo building on the Schuylkill River, which is a beautiful building. 100% of the people who have bought those condos are from outside the city. People who have the means can live in Radnor, can live in Cherry Hill, they can live anywhere they want. They live in the city, there needs to be an incentive to incentivize folks to do that. I recognize that if you're a multi-generational Philadelphian and you live next to a young lawyer who just moved into the city and he has a 10-year tax abatement and you don't, I recognize the clear unfairness in your mind to that. But we believe that none of the development that has taken place in the city would have taken place without the abatement. And I've always given this Chase Utley example. When he moved into a condo in Center City, he got a tax abatement and people complained that he was a multimillionaire and he didn't need one. But the 2 years of his wage tax, just 2 years of his wage tax, paid his 10-year tax abatement off. So, I mean, when we have a city, while we fight poverty and try to reduce the level of poverty in the city, I need wealthier people living here so we can pay for some of the services that folks need. And I will entertain any ideas on modifying the tax abatement, but I haven't heard one yet that gets us where we need to be. So council is free to come up with any type of modification that they want to come up with.
David, thanks for calling into Radio Times, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. But Mayor Kenney, if people are wealthy, I mean, they can afford to move into the city. I mean, I think what David is getting to is there, and you alluded to this, kind of unfairness for people that have lived here for generations, sort of feeling like somehow it doesn't seem right.
But what is the positive bottom line if the people don't move in? I mean, if we have wealthy people who are empty nesters who are willing to move into the city and believe that they need an incentive to do so. But you have to remember, after 10 years, and this tax abatement's been in there for a long time, a lot of the properties, many of the properties that were on the tax abatement to begin with are now coming back on the tax rolls. And I don't believe those properties would have ever been built without the abatement.
Let me get Paul from Langhorne to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Paul. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Jim. Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
Thank you for letting me on. And congratulations to Jim on his success with the soda tax.
Thank you.
We are actually some of those empty nesters who are moving into Center City from the burbs and very much looking forward to it. So my question is not to add to your burdens, but I just would hate for our beautiful city to create a negative impression, you know, with visitors, because we do have some unfortunate homeless people. And I'd kind of like to know what the city's plans are to help the homeless get off the streets prior to the DNC convention and longer term.
Fair enough, Paul. Thanks for the call.
I'm more concerned about the homeless folks out there than I am concerned about what it looks like. And it is disgraceful in this country, the wealthiest country in the world, that we do have people in that condition. And we work closely with people like Mary Scullion and others Sister Mary Scullion and others to address this problem. We have teams that are out there every day trying to talk to people to get them into services they need, trying to expand the number of beds we have to get people in. But, you know, people are homeless for many, many reasons. I mean, we have people out on the streets now that are addicted to heroin because they were enticed by drug companies and unscrupulous doctors to take pain medication, which hooked them on the opioids, which then led them to heroin. So, I mean, there's a lot of responsibility and blame to go around, and we have to figure out what we have to have increased education, increase access to education for our people. We have to increase opportunities for jobs for folks, and we have to fight this opioid and heroin problem epidemic at its root. And its root is the large drug companies and doctors who give these pills away to people like candy.
I'm looking at an article actually in the Philadelphia Inquirer today. How did scores of homeless come to live at the convention center?
Right.
Are you saying that once the convention, once the Democrats are in town, these people will stay, or will they be?
Every case is different. You can't apply one solution to multiple people's problems and why they're there.
But you're not going to sweep them up.
No, absolutely. First of all, it's not our place to sweep anybody up, and it's illegal. I mean, we have people, advocates will go to federal court and stop us immediately. So we're not going that route. It is unfortunate, and it is in every major city in our country, which says more about our country than it does about the homeless people.
Mm.
But the issue for us is trying to find individual solutions for people to get them where they need to be, to get the services they need, the drug treatment they need, the job training they need, and it's not an easy task, and it's something we have to work on every single day, and it is frustrating, and I know it's disconcerting to people to see, but we can't hide our problems. We need to address them.
And apparently there are something like 700 homeless people in Philadelphia. Compared to other cities, that's a very small percentage of the
it's
population.
Still one person's too many, as Sister Mary says, and no one's home unless we're all home. But we have 200 to 300 people living on train tracks in Kensington, because they're addicted to heroin. And a lot of what you see concentrated now in Center City near the convention center has to do with construction disruption, where people were staying in Love Park and out on the parkway, and they've been consolidated into one area because it's dry, it has overhang, and it's relatively safe. Look, it pains me, it breaks my heart, and it concerns me to see it, but it is what it is, and we need to address it in a holistic way and not just sweep people under the rug.
That's Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kenney, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, talking about a whole host of things on his to-do list here in Philadelphia. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. You can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. If you're just joining us, our guest is Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kenney. He's been on the job for 6 months, a longtime member of Philadelphia City Council before he became mayor. And we've been talking about the soda tax that was just passed, also planning for the Democratic National Convention. And we've got some other things to talk about as well, including some prison reform ideas, the city's intractable problems of poverty, of course, schools, pensions. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. You want to reduce the prison population by about a third over a 3-year period as mayor. How do you want to do that?
Well, we've started on the front end by decriminalizing a lot of things that used to be criminal, possessions of small amounts of marijuana, things we just signed the other day relative to public drunkenness and failure to disperse and those kind of petty crimes. So they're not criminal. They don't get you into the criminal system anymore. We have to also understand that what mass incarceration in this country has not worked. We are probably the most locked up country in the world, and it doesn't reduce crime. I mean, what most of the folks who are in our county facility up on State Road is about 7,500 or so at any given time, are there because of drug addiction, because their crimes were related to their use and abuse of drugs. So what they really need is drug treatment and job training, and they're not getting it necessarily in an incarcerated situation. So how we can do more diversion, how we can make sure that people who really – and about 60% of the people who are on State Road can't make bail. So they've been before a judge in an arraignment. Judge sets bail, and they don't have a job or anybody to pay their bail, so they wind up going up the state road for $130 a day on our time, on our dime, when they could be doing something more productive. So we're looking, we got a grant from the MacArthur Foundation, I think $3.1 million, and we're working with our criminal justice coordinator, Judge Lerner. We're working with the Common Police Court, with the police department and others to try to figure out strategies on how we can continue to divert people into areas where they need to be to get the help they need and not simply just lock them up.
I've been doing this a long time. I've interviewed a lot of mayors of Philadelphia. One of the sort of longstanding intractable problems is the rate of poverty in the city. Yeah. Among top 10 cities, it has
It's number one.
It's number one when it comes to poverty. Yeah. How do you suggest, and what are different ways of addressing this problem?
Well, we're doing that through our beverage tax relative to education and community schools and facilities and communities that allow people to organize and take care of their kids and recreate their kids and educate their kids better. We're looking at expanding the Port of Philadelphia to a more containerized port, which will allow people without a college education to get a job that's $30 or $40 an hour with benefits. We're looking at expanding diversity in the building and construction trades, which has been attempted for years, and we're going to be successful in getting that done with the cooperation of the unions. And we're looking to create a situation where people get living wages and wages they're able to raise families with. I mean, you can't – if you're a single mom, you can't raise people – you can't raise kids on $7.50 an hour. And we've been pushing that wage issue. $15's not enough, but $15's better than $7.50. So we have industries in this city that are still paying people slave wages. So we have to get the quality of education up, the quality of job training and drug treatment, and get people to become productive citizens. Because there's no downside to that. I mean, you know, locking someone up might make you think you're safer, but it's not. That doesn't make you any safer.
There's a lot of construction going on in the city. I think anyone that walks around can certainly see that. And this is just more anecdotal. When I walk by a lot of these sites, I rarely see a person of color.
Yes, and that's true, and that's a problem. I mean, but that doesn't mean we can't resolve it. And I think one of the ways we can really put a dent in this issue is our rebuild of it could potentially be $600 million in construction on parks, recreation centers, and libraries. And we're working now on developing a pre-apprentice program for our young people to move into those trades, so that when they're done with these projects, they have a union card and are able to move from another job to the next job to the next job.
And union is on board?
They've been very cooperative. We work with the Building Trades Council. I'm working with them daily with our deputy mayor for labor, Rich Laser, is working with them to develop this plan. And I can assure you that council is very, very sensitive to this issue and has brought it up many, many times. And we won't be able to get the approval on the bond on the borrowings to do this project unless we have a very tight and clear plan to change this issue.
I got a press release from your office. Office of Economic Opportunity releases disparity study, increasing participation goal to 35%.
That's our goal. I mean, that's the direction we're going in. And that's just
and
not.
And so what is it now, about 30?
Maybe even less. Right. And it's according to what project it is and what phase of a project. There are certain trades that have more diversity that in certain phases of a particular development, you know, there's more people right. of color on the site. But what we need to do is to get kids who don't really want to go to college or can't afford to go to college to get into a trade, a mechanical trade that will allow them to make a good living for the rest of their lives.
Let me get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. This is Ann from Graduate Hospital area. Ann, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi there. The developer of One Water Street backed out of his deal to provide 25 units of subsidized housing. The $3.75 million fee he's now going to pay does not begin to pay for those units. Why doesn't he have to provide funds to fully pay for the 25 units?
And this is something that Inga Saffron wrote about in the Inquirer.
Right, and we believe that this is a reasonable solution to his trying to get out of his deal. Actually, we were not on very strong legal footing because in the code, he has the ability to substitute right now, and we're going to change that, had the ability to substitute public art, retail space, and others to get the points he needed for the additional space that he was able to build, the additional height he was able to build. So we had some question of whether or not we could actually win that in court. So that negotiation provided $3.75 million, which the CDC groups think was appropriate for the number of units, and there will be affordable housing that will come about as a result of that payment. Mm. He could have fought us and perhaps won with just public art and retail space and the like, and LEED certification, because our code was insufficient to keep that from happening. That is going to be corrected. So there will be no, if any developer in the future decides that they're going to offer or pledge moderate income housing or, in their development, they won't be able to get other points to get out of that deal. So this was a one and done, and we're going to fix that situation going forward.
I'm looking at what Inga wrote, that the company was allowed to add 5 extra stories and 30 full-priced units to the building. The idea that,
right.
I mean, they really did renege on their agreement.
They did, but the formula that was used was approved by everyone, including the housing advocates, that in fact the 3.75 was commensurate with the 25 units, the value of the cost of construction, and that will be used to build affordable housing in other areas of the city. So, look, it's not the perfect situation. We wish that he didn't want to renege on that, but he looked as if legally he had the right to reconfigure the points, and we would have got nothing. So we got something. We're going to fix the code, and that won't happen in the future.
And I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me see what Patrick from Northern Liberties has to say. Patrick, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, 2 comments. First would be, you know, the sugary drink tax. You have a situation where you had mentioned that the sugary drink producers have been profiting off the poor communities, and that this is their you know, chance to pay back. But it's not the sugary drink producers that are going to pay. It's the poor people in the poor communities that are going to pay the extra money for these sodas. And the second point is, you know, we have a city that decriminalized marijuana, but if you look at the arrests now, it's still so lopsided in the sense of African-Americans to Caucasians that the new law, the way it's being implemented, it's only being used against black people still. So it's, you know, what you need to do, you want to stimulate the economy, I think you should legalize cannabis inside of the city of Philadelphia.
I agree.
Well, Patrick, let me see what the mayor has to say.
First of all, we can't legalize cannabis inside Philadelphia because it's a state law. I believe that it should be legalized and it should be used recreationally for people who are over 21 and should be sold through Pennsylvania state stores, which are a closed shop, which ensures that only people who are of age can purchase it. People are purchasing it now and they're getting it different places, and there's no benefit to the state or the city as a result of taxes. So, I mean, I do agree with that. We've gotten medical marijuana, which is the first step. But, I mean, it's going to be a little while before the state decides they're going to legalize it. Second of all, I mean, look.
He's saying who pays this tax?
Well, everyone who buys a diet drink will contribute to the tax. But people should maybe choose to drink water. I mean, I think that may be the way to go. And if that happens more in poor neighborhoods, I think that poor kids will be healthier as a result of it. But in the end, all the profit from the soda, whether it was sweetened or unsweetened, was going to the beverage companies, and none of it was staying in the community. So this way, at least, whatever people purchase and whatever the price they purchase it at, a portion of that will stay in the community to make those communities better, healthier, and more educated.
Is there sort of a built-in problem here, which is that you tax something hoping people won't use it, and then you don't make the money that you're hoping that will be generated?
That doesn't seem to work, because that doesn't seem to be true, because in Mexico they have a similar tax. This consumption actually went up. I don't know what, you know, the unknown is the unknown. I don't know what they're going to pass on. I don't know if they're going to sue us. I don't know, you know, what the consumption rate's going to be. I mean, these are all things that remain to be seen. But in our legislation, we baked in a 55% drop off in sales, which is ridiculously high. So it's never going to be that high. And we still make the money we need to fund these programs.
Patrick, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call us again, 1-888-477-9499, if you have any questions or comments for Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kenney. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. There is much exciting stuff that's been happening in Philadelphia over the last couple of decades. But is there a danger of two Philadelphians? The idea that you've got these, you know, these booming parts of the city.
Right.
In previous days, I used to work in Fishtown is a case manager knocking on poor people's doors. You go to Fishtown now, and it's really unrecognizable. Can we figure out how gentrification can be a benefit for everybody?
Well, we have two Phillies now. I mean, we have a 26% poverty rate. They're two Philadelphians, two right. different experiences. I'll harken back to the education issue, and it's look, this happened over generations. This didn't happen. We're not going to solve this in this administration's first term, but we're hoping to get the resolution on the track when it comes to education and better health and better opportunities for people in our communities, that we show them that there is hope there. And it's not, I mean, I think a young person who picks up a gun who's 22, 25 years old probably doesn't think he's going to live to 30. And doesn't really care and doesn't think that anyone else cares. And we need to change that. And we need to make sure that we have opportunities to get these kids decent paying jobs and get them trained to do good work that can raise families and buy homes and do the things that all our parents wanted from us. But the economy, you know, the economy is fickle, and we had a really bad recession, and we're climbing out of it. And this climb out of it gives us the opportunity to open up doors for people who have been shut out in the past.
Are the schools doing their part?
I think the schools are doing whatever the best they can based on the lack of money. I mean, there's a bill in Harrisburg now, House Bill 530, which allows charter schools to set their own caps, their own limits on the number of students. I mean, that's insane. And we're fighting that off. But the other issue is that Governor Corbett took away reimbursement for charters during his term. And now the money that leaves for new charter seats is leaving directly from the public schools. I mean, you can't expect – I think the whole theory of the Corbett administration was to defund public education so it was an abject failure. And then they could turn everything over to the for-profit and not-for-profit charter companies. And that didn't work because he got booted out after the first term. So, I mean, Governor Wolf is trying his best, but the legislature has been kind of extremely reluctant to fund education as is their constitutional responsibility in the state constitution. And we're fighting that every day. Our delegation's up in Harrisburg, and Senator Williams and Senator Hughes and others are fighting, you know, in the House, Bill Keller and John Taylor, they're fighting for these things, but they're outnumbered. We need to get more moderate legislators in our legislature in order to get this resolved.
And that's Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kenney joining us on Radio Times here on WHYY. What's your reaction to the indictment of Shaka Fatah, Congressman Shaka Fatah?
I mean, the federal government investigated him. They brought a case. They indicted him. It went through the court system. Jury spoke. He was convicted, and he's gone. Hmm. I mean, you just don't do the things that he was accused of doing. If you think you can, you know, take – you know, money earmarked for nonprofit education and pay off a campaign debt, that's pretty bad. I'm sorry he did that, and I'm sorry that it turned out the way it did. But when you go down that road, as others in the past have gone down that road, you wind up getting caught. In this day and age, it's not like 50, 60 years ago, and it was wrong back then too. But the electronics and IT, people track everything you do. So, you know, don't do it, and you won't get in trouble.
Did he hurt the city? Has he hurt the city?
I think he's done some good for the city in his career, but that does not excuse the things that he is accused and convicted of doing. Every count. I mean, it wasn't like any question from the jury's perspective as to his guilt. And I'm glad he decided to resign immediately as opposed to dragging it out. And I think the fact that he resigned immediately minimized the damage to the city.
What's been the most surprising thing about being mayor of Philadelphia? I mean, you were on city council for a long time, so you certainly know this city well.
Without a doubt, the level of ownership that people have of the mayor's office. And it's not about me. It's about the office. I mean, people – I was on stage last night at the graduation ceremony for our fire department for our young cadets. And this young African-American firefighter who was just sworn in, coming across the stage, shook my hand. He said, "I never thought I'd get a chance to shake hands with the mayor." And I was like – thank you. I said, "I appreciate that. Good luck in your career. You know, thanks for being in public service." But as he walked away from me, I said, that office really meant a lot to him. And whether it was me or any other mayor in it, it means a lot to people. And they feel a need to come up to you, to talk to you, to express their views, to even to take a selfie or to shake your hand or say something nice. Just the level of profile that a mayor in the city has was very shocking to me.
You're tearing up.
Yeah, a little bit, but sorry.
I actually like it when men cry.
Thank you.
So, no, thank you so much. Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kenney, our guest on Radio Times, thank you so much for joining us. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about the program, and you can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Do stay with us for hour two. We'll be right back.